2 Romeo India Whiskey. KQRIW, my name is Dick. You'll hear K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. K2KEY, his name is Mel. Mel and Dick attempt, we don't always succeed, to organize this very enthusiastic crowd that gathers here most Sunday evenings to discuss lots of subjects. They start off discussing ham radio, and that's the so-called new technical net, where during the first hour, we discuss the so-called rapidly answered questions, or at least if it's a question that requires more depth for the answer, if the person wants to know the whole story. The deeper portion we do beyond the first hour. Also included in the first hour is the mailbag, as we call it. In other words, the emails that Mel gets from the newer people who find the TechNet, decide that, gee, these guys are having a lot of fun. They've got a ham license. I want to get a ham license. And so they ask questions. They don't yet have the ability to get on the air. The majority of what takes place in the TechNet takes place live, as you hear it. Mel, thank goodness, has volunteered to handle the mailbag, because it's more than I think I could handle. I'm not quite as dedicated as he is, I guess. You also notice that later on, late at night, we lately have been discussing some fairly deep subjects of physics. What is Mother Nature really telling us? It all got started, let me drop. You could say it all got started some time ago, in which we tried to figure out what is a radio wave. I mean, it sounds like an extremely basic question, but you'll soon discover there's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. And sometimes we get down to the physics level. You can tell by the level of the discussion that takes place there that we're babes in the woods. In other words, very few, if anybody, is an expert in that subject, or at least not the people who sign in are really experts. We're feeling our way and slowly finding out what's going on. The TechNet is kind of a peer-reviewed type of material, in that every bit of it gets recorded. Thank goodness Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has that beautiful website called amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and therefore essentially all of the TechNets for the last 5 years or 5.5 years have been recorded. And when we do make mistakes, people will review this material, bring it to our attention, and we then go around to correcting it. So not everything you hear is perfectly accurate. Gotta admit that ahead of time. Also, we may be hearing from Glenn, KC2QIQ, who has been doing some significant research on making improvements for a so-called doppel scanner. In other words, if you're a fox hunting type enthusiast, these direction finding systems made by Ramsey Electronics, among others, are workable but not refined. And Glenn has been finding ways of refining those. Last week, let me drop. The people who signed in during the early portion of the TechNet, there was a man named Ed, November 2, November Yankee Whiskey, who we didn't get a chance to get to. So if he signs in tonight, he goes to the top of the list, because he signed in last week and we didn't get to him, or he wasn't available at the time we went to him. So, the new technical net, the first hour, we try to handle everybody who signs in, at least with a brief answer. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, N2EO, Rich, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Is there anybody out there that's not watching the football game? Give you your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2EO, Rich, and yes, speak of the devil.
Into MB. I never watch football games.
Okay. That was Barry and Rich and that mysterious person named Barry. Fantastic. Okay, we got Rich and Barry. Anyone else check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Oh, yes. DTCN, yes.
Okay, that last person, there was some dropout. Please give me your call letters again and your name, sir.
It's Gordon, W2, Tango, 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 yes.
Very fine. and I'm guessing that Gordon might be mobile. On a quick break, Gordon, if we handle you earlier or a little bit later, where will you be in a position where the mobile will give you better coverage of this particular repeater? Over to you, Gordon.
Earlier is better, and I can even just, I'll dump you the question. You can decide whether you want to handle it earlier or later. The question is basically, they've revised the forecast for this spot number for this cycle to like 59, and I'm wondering if anybody has any comments or thoughts about that.
Okay, if I understand you correctly then, Gordon, sunspot cycle number 59, they revised the forecast, and I'm not really up on that. Tell me what the revision is. Are they predicting more, less, or the same? And is that the nature of your question? In other words, does someone else have greater knowledge as to what the forecast is really telling us and what they think is really going to happen? W2TTT, K2RIW.
Yeah, basically what they're saying, Dick, is that this cycle, which is not 59, I forget what it is, it's 20-something, is the revised downward to a smooth spot peak number of 59, which is yet a further reduction in the I mean, we'll have they're higher, but basically there's passing that's just yet lower yet for the peak of this current cycle. So I was wondering if anyone had thoughts on it, but other than, oh gee, isn't that terrible? But anyway, when we get to it, check in and I can handle it. I prefer earlier than later, if possible.
K2KEY, would a comment?
Go right ahead, Mel.
What he's referring to is the next cycle, this one coming up. Cycle number 24, and it's been very slow in coming. It starts, it ends, it goes up, it goes down, and its smooth average number for this cycle is going to be quite low, brief and quite low at about, as he says, around 59, and so we're not going to get anywhere near the conditions that we've had in past cycles, Dick, over.
The people who really are in love with 6 meters will all talk about that cycle that occurred in roughly 1958, where super high numbers took place and people were getting double and triple hops on 6 meters and all kinds of fancy DX was happening. I think the sunspot cycle, sunspot number got up into 150, 200, some huge number. And I guess we'd all like to see that one again. If this particular one is only going to get as high as 59, it implies that 10 meters will be open periodically, 6 meters by way of F2 propagation, not sporadic E. I guess it's going to be a bit rare, and 2 meters is out of the question. And I presume even the long-range DX on 20 meters maybe won't be so good. But I'm not an HF operator, so I'm not really up on this one. So tell me... what you think, if 59 is the peak number that we're going to get on this puny cycle that is being predicted, what bands does that mean we will not see very much activity on, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The cycle you're referring to back in the 58, 59, 60 period, went to a peak of 210. It was one of the phenomena. Since they've been, you know, tracking this stuff, this has been, I think, was the highest. There have been periods since they've been tracking going back hundreds of years. There have been periods there was no sunspot for quite a number of years. I believe there was once a hiatus of the sunspots for 50 years. There were cycles that were also kind of puny, as they say, and this is going to be, I guess, one of them. And so what do you expect? If a smooth sunspot cycle of about 59, you'll have some openings, like maybe on 15 meters, 12 and 10, very, very spotty. Nothing spectacular. You're not going to work the world as in previous cycles with a couple of watts on 10 meters with a wet noodle, literally, you know. That will not, I don't think, occur. But you'll have some decent DX, especially on bands like 20 meters thick over.
Assuming the prediction is accurate that this coming cycle, I think you said it's cycle number 24, only hits a peak smooth sunspot number of 59, and I should know and I don't, you're going to tell us, Mel, when they smooth, what is the period over which they smooth? Is it a 1 week period, a 1 month period, the smoothing? I think it's a couple of months, and I believe they do it by both a forward and a reverse kind of averaging, such that the middle of the averaged area is the date that you're at when they make a declaration. So that what is the smoothing period? And because of the smoothing process, the instantaneous peaks of the sunspots don't necessarily show up as that smooth number. So even if we only get 59, does that negate that we won't get a one-day spike of 100, and therefore a really diligent person is not going to miss a super band opening that's going to happen for a few hours a particular day? So what's the period of time over a smooth, and you think there's a possibility we'll get a spike that's well above 59, even though the smooth number may not get above 59? K2KEY, K2RIW.
What they do with the smooth is they measure the cycle, the beginning to the end of the cycle, look at the peaks, and put it all together and find that, well, I could say this is what it averaged to, that yes, you no doubt will get situations that it may jump 100 or more. It could very possibly be, but they'll be more sporadic than constant. When I mentioned like 1958, 59, 60, the sunspot did peak at 210, but it stayed over the period. The smooth sunspot of that era was way up there, 150 or something like that, really way up there. So that was the average if you want to take all the months of the sunspot cycle together and average it out, divided by the period from beginning to end, that's where it wound up. And I could say it did hit its peak at 210. So this will, from the beginning to its end, divide it up somewhere, like he says, around 59. But you will have, no doubt. You're just going to have to sit around. And that's why I have a spectrum scope. Many times I'll sit on one of those bands, like 10 meters or 6 meters, and do my thing, and every so often look at a pip on the scope. If I see it pop something, I take a look at what it is, Dick. Over.
Yeah, from time to time I hear direct or indirect evidence that our weather is affected by the sunspot cycle. There was that period of time, I think it was in the early 1600s, which I believe is called the Maunder Minimum, because my man with that last name recognized it. And for something like a 50-year period of time, there was essentially no recognizable sunspot. And I think also during that period of time they had extremely cold weather. I think the summertime was very disappointing. Crops failed and so on. So I believe they also see a significant correlation between tree ring research, where you look at how healthy was the growth of trees during those particular years versus the sunspots for those particular years. And I think there's a correlation there. On the assumption that the sunspot cycle is going to be disappointing this time, Gordon, I wonder if you would make a prediction that it might actually create more enthusiasm for ham radio operators to operate on the upper VHF, UHF bands, because there you do not depend on the sunspot cycle, because a person making a contact on 432, let me drop. The 432 person and the 2-meter person, for the most part, thinks there is no sunspots. There is no ionosphere per se. The sunspots strongly interfere how dense is the ionosphere, how reflective it is. And so a person on 2 meters and above really doesn't use the ionosphere. Yes, occasionally there's something called sporadic E propagation, which happens for short periods of time, which is very non-dependent on the sunspot cycle. That'll occasionally give you 10, 6 meters, and occasionally 2 meter very long range propagation. But Gordon runs the technical net that's on the Barra repeater on Thursday nights, and so since that's a VHF group, or at least that portion of the group is VHF, I wonder if, Gordon, you're possibly predicting that some of the guys who normally would be emphasizing HF will do a little bit more emphasis of VHF and UHF. W2, tango, 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 to take it, Gordon. And by the way, if you are parked, you might want to race the motor a little bit, because I do hear occasional dropouts of your repeater, your transmitter, and maybe it's because of low battery voltage, if you know what I mean. You got it, Gordon. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, Dick, I'm glad you said something about that, because I do have a regulator to make sure that I can do that. I just fired the car a little bit. Well, personally, I think there has been and there will continue to be more 6-meter activity. Frankly, as more radios have 6 meters in, more HF radios are now coming with 6 meters. 2-meter activity has fallen off over the last few years during our sunspot minimum, so I have no inclination to think that there will be more activity on 2-meter sideband, which does not bode well for 20, 430, etc. I just don't see it. Having said that, I'm going to put up a 4-bay array on 2 meters in the thing. Decide which way I want to orient it. That's a subject of future discussion. They're 13 element, mini boomers, so I haven't decided whether I'm going to put them as a stack, 9-inch inch part, along the mast, or whether I'm going to do something. So I haven't decided. That's a lot of mast, I'll just say that, to do that with. The other is the H frame. Again, that's still a lot. I also have to worry about my pigeon finding new homes over my cars when I do that, which is annoying. I just thinking that, if HF radio isn't hot, and if low part of VHF radio isn't very hot, then we're more challenges in getting people interested in HF radio, and therefore interested in amateur radio with modest antennas. More and more people are feeling pressure on the antennas. So if you can't just throw a wire up and expect to talk to the world, then I think challenge is getting more people active. So that will require other kinds of amateur radio to evolve and attract people. Everything from getting involved in Echo Link and things like that, D-Star, and anything else that you can do that's portable or so people can enjoy a bit on the fly without being ultra geeky. Gone are the days without sunspots, gone are the days where someone can put up a 30-foot dipole antenna and be on 20 meters and work the world. Yes, you can do that, but you're not going to do it every day on demand, and therein lies the risk. So, that's why I was concerned that no sunspots equals less interest in ham, period. Anyway, I think this to death, you've been very gracious. I don't want to take up your first hour time any more than necessary, but thank you, K2RAW. And by the way, the net is Barra's net, Thursday nights at 9, but it's on the Chestnut Ridge 146955. Repeater, 146.955 repeater, the PL's 141.3. So format's a little different than Dick's. I like, I like both formats, but they're just very, very different nets. Ours is kind of like, the tactical Mr. Wizard for an hour, hour and a half. And this is like a treatise in, and master's thesis work in RF design, coupled with the Shep Answerman at the beginning, which I love. This is a great net. K2RAW, W2TPT.
keep paying Gordon, and he keeps giving these testimonials as to how good this particular tech net is. That's a bit of a joke. The Barra Technical Net on Thursday nights, you can also find those recorded on the exact same location, amateurradio.tangovictor. So if you really like technical nets, there's two different ones you can listen to, and recordings are there for both. One of the things you should know, Gordon, is that of your last three transmissions, all of them have the exact same characteristic. Once every once and a quarter seconds, continuously, with extremely accurate timing, your transmitter drops out. It drops out for one syllable of whatever you're saying, and then comes back. And it does it one and a quarter seconds. I looked at it on my watch, and extremely accurate timing. So I'm not quite sure what that means. So as I said, you have a blast of noise that comes through. Your RF completely drops out, it appears, once every one and a quarter seconds, and it does it for a few milliseconds, one syllable of your voice. Maybe it's low battery voltage because you're parked. I know that my mobile transmitter acts kind of crazy in my car if I operate it without the engine running. With the engine running, your battery goes up to like 14 volts, 13.8 volts, and most chunks of electronics get pretty happy. One of my rigs in the car runs from a cigarette lighter, and with the voltage drop from the battery, if the engine is not running, the poor rig goes down to like 11.5 volts. And my Kenwood, what is now, 732, I think it is the Kenwood all-mode 2-meter rig. It really doesn't want to see less than 12 volts, otherwise it goes crazy. So, alrighty, we've got Rich and Barry in that order. Let's go to Rich, N2EO. What would you like to talk about tonight?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Now, the good thing about Gordon's transmitter dropping out every 1.25 seconds is that he never times out the machine. N2EO, you got it, Rich. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Oh, let me wait for the beep. N2EO. Half inch hardline, put a preamp in the shack. It made a difference, but not a big difference. Here, the one on the tower seems to be almost mandatory. I guess, I don't know, but I guess that's because of the run of LMR 400, which is almost 100 feet, Dick. Back to net. N2EO. And by the way, what do you think I ought to do for 1296? I was thinking of a preamp up there on the tower, and maybe putting an amp. It's going to be a 50 watt hour transverter also on 1.2. I thought I might mount a 100 watt amplifier in the attic, where it's only about 25 feet of feed line from there to the antenna. Back to net, N2EO.
On a quick break, Rich, you know, because you bought it, you've looked it up, and when it comes to RG8 and RG58 and quite a few of the other cables, and when it comes to the half inch, three quarter inch, 7/8 and whatever hard lines, I know the insertion losses. I don't have memorized the insertion loss of LMR 400 at 432 per 100 feet. I'm going to make a guess of approximately 4 decibels of loss, 100 feet of LMR 400 at 432. Do you believe that's approximately the right ballpark? In which case, I've got some good news for you. Over to you, Rich.
Not sure, Dick. I did look it up, but I don't remember. It's months ago. Maybe it's more than that. I don't know. Like I say, I'm very dependent on, if I take off the preamp, I can hardly hear stations. And if I turn off the preamp on 10 meters that's built into the Elecraft K2, I don't hear anything hardly. So I don't know if the converter is gain-starved, something is wrong, or if it's just the losses in the feed line. That's my concern, Dick.
Okay, I think you came to the right place. I'm going to make a guess that LMR 400, it has that number because it's 4/10 of an inch of outside diameter. The real outer layer of the shield is probably 0.7 or so inches in diameter. I think it's a foam-filled cable. It's a little bit better than RG8. RG8 is a little bit lower in diameter, polyethylene, and it runs 4.5 to 5 dB per loss per 100 feet at 432. So LMR 400 is going to be pushing 3.5 or 4 dB. Let's assume it's 4 dB. I'll round off the numbers. And I'll show you what's going on. If your Elecraft is really having the sensitivity it should have on 28 megs, if the downeast microwave transverter, which converts 432 down to 28 megs, if it really has, let's say, 18 dB of gain, and if it has a 1 dB noise figure preamp, if everything is working correctly, and there's a way you can test that, you know that, then if that downeast microwave transverter was mounted at the mast with 1 dB of noise figure, if it really has that 1 dB of noise figure, then your sensitivity on 432 would be quite good. Because you've got 4 dB of cable loss on the LMR 400, in my estimation, and insertion loss and dBs go up almost in a linear manner, so therefore 1 dB of system plus 4 dB of cable is a 5 dB noise figure at the antenna. Your preamplifier from Advanced Receiver Research, a really good one, has got around a half a dB noise figure. So we're comparing now half a dB of noise figure when the preamp is turned on. I'm assuming now that with almost 20 dB of gain in that preamp, it overrides almost everything downrange, and it gives you close to a half a dB, three-quarters of a dB noise figure, with preamp turned on. Turn the preamp off, and your noise figure is going to go to 5 and a fraction.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
5 and a fraction dB. To a person with a good set of ears, listening to a weak sideband signal or listening to a weak Morse code signal, half dB noise figure versus 4.5 dB of noise figure definitely is the difference between a QSO or a non-QSO. A half dB noise figure front end, you now have the sensitivity, even though you're up on a nice high frequency 432, you start hearing all kinds of clicks and pops of all the man-made noise in the neighborhood. Every time somebody turns on a switch and makes makes a microsecond burst of 432, and if your sensitivity is good enough, you hear it. However, if anything has failed downrange, in other words, if your downeast microwave, let me drop. If your downeast microwave is not giving you its rated 18 dB of gain, if your Elecraft has had any kind of a failure where its noise figure of its front end is not what it's supposed to be, then your sensitivity can degrade real fast. And in other words, somebody not giving the right amount of gain or noise figure downrange with the preamp turned off at the antenna, your noise figure, which on a good day is going to be 4.5 dB, it could easily climb to 12 and 15 and 20 dB of noise figure, which really makes everything, makes the band very, very dead. If you've got a signal generator, it isn't too difficult a test for you to take the signal generator and measure what is the real sensitivity of the Elecraft at 28 megs, or go one step downrange. What is the real sensitivity of the 432 transverter when it's in front of the Elecraft? And I can tell you how many microvolts or what dBm you should be able to hear in order to get either a 12 dB of sine ad, 20 dB of quieting if you're in the FM mode, or how far you've got to go with the signal generator to get 20 dB of quieting of the noise in the background, or what signal strength and microvolts you should have in order to get a reasonable Morse code signal in the noise. There's various ways you can do that. So where you've got this doubt, I would start off with the hardware in the shack. Obviously that preamp is flying like a charm. Looks like Barry did a good job of an installation there, but is the hardware in the shack doing the right job is the next thing for you to do. And when it comes to 1296, where feed line loss is a hell of a lot higher, whatever you're discovering right now with line driving preamplifiers at the antenna, your need on 1296 is going to be multiplied multiple times as to that requirement, if you know what I mean. Am I correct in assuming you've either got or can borrow from Barry or from your own shop a signal generator by which...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A signal generator by which you can measure those sensitivities of the sensitivities and or gains. In other words, it'd be very nice to put a 1 microvolt signal in front of the downeast microwave at 432 and look at the S meter on the Elecraft, and then put 1 microvolt, or how many microvolts do you have to put directly into the Elecraft at 28 megs in order to get the same S meter reading. That'll tell you what the gain was for the downeast microwave. So where you're seeing that drastic a difference, I think you're well into the area where you'd like to be doing some measurements with your signal generator. You believe you have the ability to do that, Rich, and if not, I'll bet you Barry can arrange it for you. N2EO, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I can do that, Dick, because I own a WaveTech 3000B service monitor, which has a calibrated output. So that's what, I guess that is my next step. What I'm also curious about is what you mentioned, at 1296, the demands are literally three times. Now, if I run that type of cable, I need 100 feet to get from the top of the tower down here. And I put a half a dB noise figure gas set on the tower. Is 18 or 20 dB with a half dB noise figure going to be enough to override the losses in that cable? Because if we got 4 dB loss at 432, triple the frequency, you triple the loss. It's a linear function, 12 dB.
KC2, QIQ.
KEY coming.
Yeah, Glenn and Mel in that order. And no, it's not necessarily triple. When you look at the curves for insertion loss of a cable versus frequency, let's see now. Copper loss is linear. Dielectric loss is square root. No, the other way around. Insertion loss is a square root. And copper loss, when it goes linear when you get into the dielectric loss at the higher frequencies. You can look this all up. And by the way, how many dB of gain will override what noise figure? There is no exact answer. There's a whole bunch of rules of thumb. One of the rules of thumb is that if the amount of gain of your low noise preamplifier is greater than the noise figure of the stuff downrange, usually it's a good working relationship. However, there's something you can Google and find out about. Let me drop. It's called the cascaded noise figure formula. When you Google the word cascaded noise figure formula, you'll either see the formula, you'll find a couple of websites where you simply fill in the blanks. It asks you, well, what is the gain of the preamp, what's the noise figure of the preamp, what's the gain of the next stage, the noise figure of the next stage, and so on. You fill in the blanks, and in a millisecond after you press go, it tells you the answer. Or you can plug in numbers yourself with your handheld calculator with the cascaded noise figure formula. What you will discover is as the preamplifier gain gets higher and higher, the overall noise figure of the system continues to improve. That's the good news. What you're looking for is where's the knee of the curve, because there's a certain point beyond which you get a law of diminishing returns, so to speak. In other words, if I've got a 10 dB noise figure back end of the receiver, and I've got 15 dB of gain in the preamplifier and half a dB of noise figure in the preamplifier, you go through the mathematics, that's pretty darn good. And when you go from 15 dB of preamplifier gain to 35 dB of preamplifier gain in that example, you only pick up another half dB of improvement, so to speak. However, you make the preamplifier gain too high, and now you're extremely vulnerable to overload for any strong signal that may be way out of band. A good preamplifier like the AR-squared, the good news is that they got lots of noise figure and lots of gain at 432. The bad news is they've got a lot of gain 100 megacycles higher and 100 megacycles lower. So you could have a taxi cab transmitter in your neighborhood that's 100 megacycles away, that's three blocks away, it comes on the air and overloads your whole system because of a whole lot of front-end gain. If you don't have an extremely good bandpass filter there to protect the rest of the system. So the ideal amount of gain is a compromise. More gain, better noise figure. More gain, worse intercept point as far as third order intercept and intermodulation, distortion, and overload, and whatever.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So you're looking for that compromise. Now, Glenn and Mel are going to make some comments on this. Glenn first, and when we get a chance, we'd like to hear what you've been discovering with that beautiful pictures you mailed me on the modifications you're making, Glenn, for the, I'm guessing it's a Ramsey kit that you may have started with, but maybe it's a different kit on the Doppel scanner. KC2 QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. And I just had the Alamore data sheet up, and I was taking a peek at it while you and Rich were talking. And it looks like the Alamore is actually, the 400 is pretty good. At 450 megahertz, the data sheet says it's about 2.7 dB of insertion loss, and up at a gigahertz, it's only 4. So it's really not all that bad. And if you want later on, Dick, we'll talk about the Doppler stuff. And yes, it is a Ramsey kit, but I'll pass it back to you for now. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. With the 2.7 dB, if that's what it is, if everything is perfect, and 1 dB of noise figure on the AR squared, on the downeast microwave, that would give you 3.7 total, whereas when you turn on the preamp, you're going to come very close to 0.5. 0.5 to 3.7, is that worth fighting for? Absolutely. That'll make an awful lot of difference in what you hear on weak signals. On an extremely strong signal, you wouldn't hear that much difference. From what you're describing, though, Rich, I think there's a medium probability that when you do these measurements where you've already owned a service monitor, you own the test equipment that allows you to evaluate every one of your pieces of electronics one step at a time, traceable to the bureau. And all we've got to do is convince you to turn them on, to twist the knobs, and to adjust the cables in the right place there, Rich. Let's see what Mel wants to say on this one also. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
Exactly what I was going to say was just looking at the chart on coax cables. They have it in the QST. Let's see, what month? The new QST, isn't it? February 2011. Looking at, let's see, LMR 400 at 1,000 megahertz, 4.2 per 100. LMR 240
8.1, LMR 200, 10.1 at 1,000 megahertz. So, there you are. That's the story on the cable. Guess you can't beat hardline. Looks like the hardline comes in at the best bang for the dollar on 1,000 meg stick. Over.
I'm looking at the February issue. What page are you on, Mel?
Page 49.
I should have remembered that. Yeah, Joel Hallis's latest article on how you choose selecting the best coax for your next antenna. Beautiful. I should have remembered that. I assumed that you went to the advertisers index and went to the LMR advertisement itself. I was amazed that the advertisement would give you that much information, so now I see where it was coming from. Very well done. Rich, when you do make those measurements with your service monitor at the various components of your system, in other words, measuring the Elecraft barefoot or measuring the advanced receiver research, correction, Downey's microwave, I would measure the Downey's microwave first. And if you get what you believe is a reasonable sensitivity there, you don't have to measure downrange. But if you don't get what you think is 1 dB of sensitivity, 1 dB of noise figure type sensitivity, and if need be, I can show you how to make the calculation for that, then you're going to start breaking the system down. When you make those measurements, please come back and tell us what you found, because you've got the hardware. You're better equipped than almost all the other guys that are listening to us, and so what you find is going to be fascinating. And thank you for bringing that to our attention, Rich. Let me go over to Barry. Barry, N2MB, what's the latest on that beautiful vertical antenna of yours? And are you still tearing up the band with that thing? N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, I actually am on a phone call, so I'm gonna get back to you guys in a few moments, but I just wanted to say that the project is running into a little bit of a snag. I was running some measurements with Richie earlier tonight, and listening to a station coming through from Australia. Neither one of us could hear that station. I haven't been able to be successful. I was successful working in New Zealand, Australia, Japan, Hawaii, and some of the islands out in the Pacific, which was my main goal, putting up this antenna. And by the way, I worked all of them long path, which is very strange. I'm finding in the short path direction, which is west of me, of course, my tower might be interfering with the antenna. That may not be a serious problem. Looking at that, because what I'm looking for here is front to back and not so much gain, so I think I might be okay when I put the antenna up on the other side of the tower. But I think I'm also getting an awful lot of noise here in New York. I think Richie is too. And that might explain why I'm having trouble long past hearing those stations I just mentioned. They're very, very weak, and many nights they don't come in, whereas other people seem to be on demand and hearing them. I'm not sure what that's all about. It's up for a little bit of research. Anyway, I got to get back to my phone call, and I will rejoin you guys in about 15 minutes. N2MB.
Yeah, when you get a chance, Barry, when you come back, I'll show you how to calculate exactly what your tower is doing in that direction, and you'd be amazed how geometric the problem is. Okay, we've only had two people that signed in with the quick questions during the new TechNet, the first hour, Rich N2EO and Barry N2MB, and also Gordon W2TTT. We've covered those guys already. Is there another person, like, for instance, our carryover from last week, Ed, N2 November Yankee Whiskey, is he there? Or if anyone else has a question for the TechNet, give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
Whiskey Ocean 2 Zulu, name is Ian, India Alpha November.
West to end, Paul. The space
report. Okay, we've got Ian and Paul. Was there another person in there?
No, Echo, 2 Echo, Juliet, portable port.
Okay, and Eric, do you want us to put you on the list for people with a question or a comment? Over to you, Eric.
No, I just wanted to say hello. I'm down here in Florida, and it's a little cold, but not as cold as it is up there. And we'll be listening here. You know, if something interesting comes up, I'll be around. K2RIW, K3J, keep calling Florida.
Yeah, at my house tonight, my thermometer's reading something like 10 degrees, and they're predicting it to go even colder. I'm on a little bit of a hilltop here in Huntington, so I get a little bit more snow and a little bit colder temperatures than everyone else do. So we're really suffering up here, and you got to be down there with all that warm Florida weather. Oh, well. Ian, Whiskey Zero, WO2 Zulu, go right ahead. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, good night to you, Dick, and the net. Just a quick question, nothing too technical. I'm looking for maybe a source for a manual for Scientific Radio Systems Incorporated VHF power amplifier. And the model number on that is 410 Alpha SR, SAM Radio 410 Alpha. And the name of the company was Scientific Radio Systems Incorporated.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard of that brand name before. I presume you've already done a website, in other words, a Google or other kinds of search engines. I presume you've done a search, and that would help some. So, Ian's looking for a manual for his Model 410 Alpha Scientific Radio Systems Incorporated signal generator, if I remember correctly. An unusual sounding machine. Out of curiosity, Ian, did you get that at a flea market? Where did that come from, Ian?
Yeah, I picked it up on eBay there, Dick. No, it's a VHF. It's a 2-meter, 144 meg RF amplifier. Uses a iMac 8877 tube.
Oh, that's a pretty serious piece of hardware. That 8877 tube itself is pretty expensive. Okay, now, in the case of a single tube amplifier, I'm wondering what makes you feel that you need the manual for it, because a single tube amplifier, quite possibly it's running grounded grid. You did say 144 meg linear amplifier. I'm presuming a linear amplifier. And I imagine with an 8877, that thing is capable of quite a few hundred watts of output. Once you supply it the correct power supply and the right bias voltage, as long as the input network is resonating at 2 meters and the output network is resonating at 2 meters, from that point on, what that amplifier does is strictly between you and iMac, if you know what I mean, assuming that the tube is manufactured by iMac. Once you've got the 8877 tube manual in your hand, and you know what bias voltage, what's the recommended standby current and so on for linear service, after that the amplifier almost doesn't count. The amplifier is a kind of a nest which provides an input tuning network, an output tuning network, and if they're working correctly, they're essentially lossless. The power supply gives you, let me pick a number, 3,000 volts on the plate, and some number of control grid bias by way of a maybe a cathode dropping resistor network. And so you almost don't need the amplifier manual itself. The majority of what you're discussing is really out of the iMac 2 manual. So let me pass it back to you, Ian, and see if you got some further questions or comments on the opinion I just expressed. WO2Z, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, Dick. The amplifier is pretty much straightforward. The only thing I was contemplating is that it has a board on there that does faults, you know, little trip the amp if certain faults are, say, too much grid current or too much plate current. And I wanted to see if it's something I could incorporate easily, if it doesn't require too much additional equipment to be connected to it. or something I should just strip out and just go the simple, straightforward route.
In the case of a 4CX250B, a 4CX800, 87, or 8877, any of these forced air-cooled external anode tubes with ceramic for the insulation, excess plate current almost doesn't matter, which is opposite of common sense. As long as you're moving enough air through the tube, even though the tube may be rated for 250 watts of plate dissipation or something like that, you can extremely exceed that. I've often done it when it comes to plate dissipation, as long as you're moving enough air through the tube. And putting a candy thermometer on the air that's exhausting from the tube will tell you that right away as to whether or not that's being exceeded. And if the air comes out of there less than 300 degrees Fahrenheit, almost always everything is hunky-dory. The only real vulnerability of a tube like that, particularly in grounded grid service, is excess control grid current. The plate current, you can double it, you can do it for half an hour, and nothing will happen. You exceed some very finite amount of control grid current, because the control grid has got very little thermal mass to it. You exceed that control grid current for, let me pick a number, 1 or 2 seconds. And if you exceed it by a large number, there's a slim possibility you can burn up the control grid. And when you do, this beautiful $500 bottle, 8877, is now a fairly useless piece of junk. So any protection network or any indicators, let me drop this. A meter on the front panel, a light that lights up, or a protection circuit that that kills the drive or does something that protects, that sensing control grid current. If there is a network in there sensing control grid current, and if it's set correctly according to the tube manual, such that it then applies some form of corrective action, I would not eliminate that, because that's the one thing you're very vulnerable to. The most dangerous condition I can think of, Ian, is if you apply drive to the amplifier, and if for any reason the plate voltage fails, but the filament is still hot. Now all of that current being created by the cathode has nowhere to go. It won't go to the plate if the plate voltage is not there. It'll all stick to the control grid instead. The control grid becomes your plate. If your normal plate current can go to 400 milliamps, your control grid current can go to 400 milliamps in that condition. And the control grid maybe is not supposed to exceed 35 milliamps, if you know what I mean. You could be 10 to 1 above the right number, and you can burn up the control grid in half a second in that example I just gave you. So a failed plate voltage with the drive applied to a grounded grid amplifier is the most dangerous thing I can think of. The second most dangerous thing is that if you adjust the tuning and loading controls on the Pi output network so that it is lightly loaded but resonated. I mean, common sense would lead you to believe if you lightly load the tube, you think you're doing the best thing for it. It's the opposite. You want to heavily load the tube, because if the plate circuit hits resonance with light loading means that you draw less than the normal amount of plate current on the full drive, then the plate voltage swing becomes very large, the control grid current goes sky high, and you can again be exceeding the specification for the tube. So I think should I give you any further information on what I just said so far, or does it already make some sense, Ian?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
W02Z, K2RIW. You got it, Ian.
K2KEY, I'll give them the info on it.
Okay, go ahead, K2KEY.
Hey, if you want to see that amplifier exactly, I know the one that you're talking about. It was basically there's a book called the ARRL, RF Amplifier Classics, and one of the articles in there is the 8877 design for 2 meters, most likely exactly, because there's very little different you can do. So they got the whole thing, you know, the whole design of it, all the specifications, and the, as Dick says, the detection circuit. You get that manual. It is called RF Amplifier Classics, and it was from issues of pages taken from both QEX and QST. And like I say, there it is, the 8877 2-meter classic amplifier. Go ahead.
Melt, that particular manual, ARRL, is roughly how many dollars and what year was that published?
Okay, just looking. It was published 2004. It was $19.95, over.
In there, to your knowledge, Melt, on the 2-meter amplifier, is there a recommended control grid current measuring protection circuit? Is there such a circuit, or is there just metering, and you're told to make sure that the control grid current on the meter doesn't go above X number of milliamps? How did that particular circuit handle it, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, this is K2KQI. I just had it. Where the heck did I just... Just had it. And I lost it. Yeah, they have on it, they had a number of protection circuits. And it's funny, I just had the info on it. They have a number of little circuits that you add on, you know, they have a number of, I'm trying to find what page it was on. Yeah, but they give all the info on, wait a minute, catch it in 1 minute. Anyhow, they give all the info on, you know, how to build and test protection circuits. That too, it looks like a, you know, a real hefty thing, but you can easily destroy it, over.
Okay, just wanted to break in here. I do have a couple of books that has the 8872 designed for 2 meters. The only thing is, why I wanted the exact manual is that this already has a whole elaborate protective circuit built into it, but I don't have the power supply that comes with it, and so I was trying to see whether or not it would be just simple enough to provide whatever voltages the board would need to actually operate, so I could actually use the built-in protective circuits that came with the amp, as opposed to stripping those away and building something or buying something to replace it.
Like I say, they got a number of protection circuits in here already, and I can't believe that they've made much of a modification, you know, to deviate much from this type of protection circuit, because they're pretty straightforward how they're doing it. So what I would suggest is you take a look at this, and if you need a power supply also for it, they got the suggested power supply in there for it, over.
Sounds to me like that manual tells you everything you want to know. Eric wanted to give us some words. Let's wait for the beep and let Eric tell us. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. It's also known as a 3CX1500, which allows you to have 1500 watts of plate dissipation. The grid will deal with up to 25 watts of dissipation. Actually, it's 8877 is a tube that we usually need. The old television transmitters that we had at the World Trade Center is a very rugged tube. Some people operate grounded grid and you drive it from the cathode. And in grid service, you really got to be very careful about it, because that tube will cost, the cost of the tube is around $700, so you want to be really careful with it. By the way, maximum plate voltage for that tube runs around 4 kilovolts, but most people run it around 2,500, 2,700 volts. K2RIW,
K2J. As I see it, Ian, there's three pieces of information you want to know about. Number one, the tube brand new is $700, so you want to protect that darn tube. Number two, 25 watts of control grid dissipation. Don't exceed that for more than a fraction of a second. And number three, the tube can take, I think he said 1,500 watts of plate dissipation. In other words, with any reasonable settings of plate current, power supply voltage, and whatever, with the right amount of air flowing through that tube, as long as your blower is working correctly, you can exceed the living daylights out of the plate dissipation, plate current, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's only the control grid you got to protect. And so, once you know the difference between cathode voltage and grid voltage, if the grid is grounded, for instance, and if the cathode goes up to 50 volts of bias under normal operating conditions, then you take the 50 volts, whatever the voltage difference is.